You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. And this month, we are looking at the queen of crime herself, Agatha Christie. Or more specifically, adaptations of her work through the ages. And to do this, I've assembled in the drawing room my two chief suspects, Julie and Sam. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there, Alan.
So I think my first question in this interrogation, and I'll start with you, Julie, is how did you become aware of Agatha Christie? How did you first learn about the suspect?
Well, when I was a very, very small girl, I used to get sent to my gran's for the weekend. And my gran had books that you could, in one word, describe as respectable. So there were the Kiplings, there were some Mary Stuarts for children, right, the specific ones. But on the shelf in the guest room, there were also Christie's. And for a very bookish young girl who lived a little bit in her own head, that was treasure to me. I didn't understand half of them. Most of them went over my head anyway. But if you ask me what introduced me to not only Christie, but also Josephine Tay, Marjorie Allingham, all the queens of crime, even Dorothy L. Sayers, it all started in the guest room at my gran's.
That sounds fantastically like a murder location as well, like the body in the guest room. How about you, Sam? How did you find out about Christie?
Well, my testimony is going to be a bit more blurry because I think everything blurred and in a little bit with Agatha Christie's name that to me as a child was kind of similar to Alfred Hitchcock at the time. You know, you saw books like The Three Question Marks and then you saw Miss Marple and you saw Hercule Poirot on the covers of books and titles like Murder on the Orient Express and I think Death on an Isle were titles that I knew early on. And I think I'm not quite sure if I came by the books first or some of the film adaptations. I must have read a couple of the more famous titles then in the course of my, you know, early teenage. I think it was exciting to read these whodunits and then, you know, find out with people who had also or were also reading it. So for me, it's a little bit of a blurry entrance into someone that was famous, that had the name on the book covers and videotape covers, something like that.
I think for me especially, it was the book covers they had in the late 70s and early 80s that are almost like the covers you would find on Video Nasties. They are horror images. They are eyeballs that have been like on their own. They're knives, they're cutting, they're skulls. There's a savagery to them in these images. And I remember being quite young and scared, but also slightly enticed by the covers, not quite enough to read them. But Agatha Christie had a similar pull, I think, of sort of like almost like horror films would have, that this looked so dark from these covers. And I think eventually, because I think the cover was one of the least scary, was the ABC Murders. And I do remember reading, that was the first one I read. And I do remember at school, we had a thing called silent reading, where I think if the teacher maybe had a hangover or just wanted a break, we'd just say to the class, everyone read for an hour. We're all doing it. And I really vividly read, the ABC Murders was the book I'd be reading. And then I got to the revelation of who it is. And, you know, it's the cliche. It did blow my mind. I was so shocked. And I remember being in this classroom of silent reading and there was no one I could just turn to and go, oh my God, it's so-and-so, it's so clever. How I didn't see it coming and then how it's a completely satisfying conclusion to that one. And I think that was like when I was hooked. I still have really happy memories of that revelation at the end of ABC Murders. And I think a lot of my interest in cozy crime is chasing that higher again. But I mean, it is interesting, just as an aside on those book covers, that it's a publishing story that Agatha Christie sales were falling in the 70s and into the 80s. And then someone at the publishing house said, well, look at these covers. These are horrible, horror-related covers. And then they rebranded it all with very sort of art deco, stylized, quite pretty images. And the sales shot up again. So they're never going to come back, these covers. But I think there's something about them that at the right time, they really struck a chord. And I think that was my gateway to Christie, and especially, I guess, her darker side. But I think, and especially with Agatha Christie, I think what we're going to do is stick with our sort of usual format. And we've each brought a adaptation of an Agatha Christie work that we've all brought to the table to sort of discuss and interrogate and look through. we'll look at these chronologically. So let's start with the film that I brought to the table, which is Murder, She Said, with Margaret Rutherford as Miss Marple. I chose this, I think, in part because in some respects, it's not a good adaptation. And in other respects, it's just a tremendously fun film. I think it's also slightly famous that Agatha Christie was a bit, oh, this isn't really my Miss Marple. But also she really liked Margaret Rutherford. And for me personally, I understand that completely. She's fantastic in this. So how did people find it, Julie? How did you find it?
Just to add to your comment earlier, she really liked Joan Hickson as well. There is this story that she told Miss Hickson that one day she would play Miss Marple. And so she did in the fantastic BBC adaptation. I loved it. Of course, I loved it. As an adaptation, this plot is solved via a sort of maid come nanny called Lucy. And Lucy has a deal with Miss Marple to solve this murder. Of course, in this film, Margaret Rutherford stomps about herself as her substantial own person. There is an old gentleman in the house known to be difficult, as they call it. And he's like Rutherford's junior by 15 years. And he's the old curmudgeon, right? It's fantastic. But it is a bit of a, I wouldn't call this satire, but it's almost pastiche. It's funny. It's quick. It's not really Christie, I would say. But do see it. It's such a blast.
How about you, Sam? What did you think of it?
Well, the funny thing is that, of course, the opening scene I knew or had known for a very long time. These two trains coinciding and then she seeing the murder. I mean, that was famous to me. What surprised me was that I actually had not seen the entire film. I must have stopped right there. Maybe a little bit of the investigation around the train track seemed familiar. But of course, I was very familiar with Margaret Rutherford's iconic representation of Miss Marple. Even though I'm still not sure if I've seen many of the other films in full, it was just one of these iconic figures. You knew this is Miss Marple. I mean, this was Miss Marple to me for the longest time until I probably saw Angela Lansbury in the Mirror Cracked. So she was kind of the quintessential, just like Ustinov was for Poirot, the one that was Miss Marple. And I never quite got the later discussion around, you know, that Rutherford was a bit, you know, too brutish, too coarse or too quirky as Miss Marple. For me, that was just her. Seeing the film now, I thought it was interesting that the way it went, you know, when she goes to that mansion and becomes the nanny, I didn't expect that. I thought the investigation would somehow circle much more around train stations, you know, who had been on there, and she would investigate maybe it go on trains and so on. So it became something else. She goes to that mansion and meets the curmudgeon upstairs and the little cheeky boy who teases her but still likes her, Alexander. I really enjoyed their interaction. And of course, the staff and all the people around the house. It is a fabulous film, down to some of the fun revelations, you know, the Egyptology part in the stable, for instance, is like, wow, who came up with this? This just, it's a lot of fun. It's spunky. It moves quickly. She is a hoot. And of course, I love any snooping around houses in the dark and stables and gardens and so on. So really, really enjoyable.
No, I think I sort of selected this because she did four films in total. And this is the first one she did as Miss Marple. And I think I sort of favored this one because it's probably the closest to a book. I mean, there's recognizably the 450 from Paddington is the basis for the story in this one. I think they get sillier and possibly more fun as they go on. They become even less about capturing maybe a Christie novel or the tone of a Christie novel. They become their own thing in terms of Margaret Rutherford is having a romp and defeating a criminal. And I mean, that is enough to get me to sign on board. But it sort of is interesting that there's a scope to which you can be quite puritanical about Christie and that an adaptation must be the book translated into a visual medium. And actually, I think these are a really good indication that you can mine Christie's work for your own end and that they did it to create these films that are of their time, that are fun adventures. they're not really the books. And I think Margaret Rutherford is both a great Miss Marple and she's not Miss Marple. That she can be the two things at the same time, because her drive to investigate feels very un-Marple.
Well, I was wondering, because maybe you know this, either of you, but I always sort of, when I saw them later, always thought that the Hickson versus the Rutherford Marples were almost two sides of a coin of the Victorian lady, you know, where Rutherford is very Sherlockian in terms of you have to be, it's very active, right? You sort of meddle with everything and you stomp around with walking sticks and go around the moors scaring luminous dogs. And Hickson is sort of much more faithful as an adaptation. This is how she was written, more or less, very in the background, very sort of unaggressive. And I feel I won't get into this too much, but in the later series of Marple, quote unquote, so that's what it's called, you also have this dichotomy. It's like, is Miss Marple a very active presence, or is she more of a fly on the wall, let's say? So it's. I always think the Rutherfords are interesting because it's also an interpretation. Apart from it being the Margaret Rutherford show, which nobody minds, it's also a sort of view on Victorianism and what it means to be a classic English town or story and a cozy mystery.
Do you have a preference then, Julie? If you say two sides of the same coin, do you? Would you say Rutherford is preferable over other interpretations then?
You know, I will get into this a little bit later. The thing with Christie and also with some of the adaptations is that she is not deep in a humanist sense, in a psychological sense. She never was. And so Rutherford goes for the theatre of it all, which is, I think, legitimate. It's sort of a show, it's a puzzle. Whereas, for instance, the BBC ones, the Hickson ones, go more into the humanism of them. There are humans in the periphery of this crime. But that is also legitimate, but that is also not Christie. Let's not forget that, right? Christie makes the puzzles. The humanism that we project onto these stories, I think, comes from the adaptations more than from the novels. So it's a bit of an involved answer, but I think we'll get to that later when we get to my pick.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely something that Hickson has been designed, and what she performs is much closer to the book Marple. And I sort of really like what you said, because I think Marple is originally envisaged as a bit of a one-off character that was Agatha Christie thinking, you know, the old lady in a village that is the gossip that no one really thinks much of. She that actually those skills that make her the old lady gossip and the nosy one actually are great for detective. That over a lifetime of doing this, you would have gained an almost complete understanding of human nature. And no one gives you credit for that because you're written off as like a little old lady. And I really like the idea that you have this old lady who just through who she is has this insight. And I think Hickson plays that really well. And she plays, you know, no one would really on first glance think that Joan Hickson's Marple would be dangerous. You would underestimate. I don't think anyone would ever underestimate Margaret Rutherford. If she came in the room, she would command the room instantly. And that's very un-Marple, but it's brilliant for this film. And I think they're all proper Sunday afternoon, sit in front of the telly, have fun. You watch a Rutherford Miss Marple, and I think I'd recommend all of them, as long as you're willing to accept that you are not seeing the stories that Agatha Christie wrote. That's the key thing. But in terms of, I think this sort of the two sides of the coin is sort of interesting in terms of how people have approached all of the adaptations. And I think that probably gives us a good chance to move on to Sam, your selection, which is the Peter Ustinov take on Evil Under the Sun. Why did you pick this one?
Well, I think because I really grew up with the film adaptations. I mean, I did see Murder on the Orient Express with Albert Finney as well. But at the same time, I think I mostly saw Death on the Nile, Evil Under the Sun, and to a lesser degree also Appointment by Death with Ustinov as Hercule Poirot. And of course, there's again this discussion about, you know, is he the worst possible Poirot? Is he the best possible Poirot? How did Albert Finney do? And then, of course, we'll also talk about David Suchet later on. I loved the all-star cast in all those films. I mean, they were glorious, plus the location photography, especially in Death on the Nile, but also in Evil Under the Sun. I do think Evil Under the Sun, to me, is my absolute favorite. Because Death on a Nile is great and production values are fantastic. The cast is stellar. It's a bit sluggish at times. It's a bit long. And I think Evil Under the Sun is just snappier and cheekier and campier. Has a fantastic cast. And I loved, and I only read about this later on, that the original novel is actually not set on the Mediterranean coast, but in some dingy Devon town, apparently. For me, that was just the combination of, you know, Ustinov, who's too hot all the time, with pale Jane Birkin and spunky Maggie Smith. And then, of course, my absolute darling Diana Rigg in probably one of her best roles on film ever.
She is eating that entire scenery and the piano.
I know, but I am so in love with her Emma Peel and her Tracy Bond, you know. But seeing her again in this film, I just thought, I mean, this film lives off Diana Rigg to a large degree, even though the rest of the cast is really good. So it's just the most enjoyable Agatha Christie adaptation that I know. And I thought it would be great to bring it in, even though I'm sure many have their quibbles with adaptation and, you know, Hercule Poirot's depiction and so on. But to me, that is the best that was ever made with an Agatha Christie novel.
Yeah, smashing, isn't it? I always think it's so misguided to view the Ustinov Poirot as Poirot adapted. This is Ustinov being Ustinov. As I understand it, he was a great raconteur in his own right. Very charming, very, you know, sociable, garrulous, that sort of big personality and presence. And they just put him in there and apparently said, you do you. And I think it works on a similar balance that the Rutherfords work, in that if you read the Poirot novels by Christie, Poirot, again, is kind of a cipher. We tend to forget this, but he is not, there's not a lot of depth to Christie's Poirot. He's meant to be the brilliant detective to solve it all in the end and put a big bow on it. And here he is imbued with so much personality. I mean, it's irresistible, isn't it? I mean, and just a word for the costumes as well. They're by Anthony Powell. Isn't it fabulous? I mean, you know, the transformation at the end.
Oh my God, yes. Jane Birkin coming down the stairs.
Jane Birkin coming down the stairs. Isn't she fabulous? Oh my goodness. I love that thing to bits. And I know it's all kitsch. You know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend it's a great work of Bellatar art, because it's not. But it's, I could have that, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner. I think it's fabulous.
It's interesting what you were saying about Ustinov as Poirot, in that I was watching, there's a Death on the Nile Blu-ray that I've got, and it's got an excellent making of from the time they were shooting it. And part of it is Peter Ustinov being interviewed, sort of like, how have you found your character of Poirot? And he makes a really interesting point that for Agatha Christie creating the character, she was very much, oh, he is not this. He's Sherlock Holmes, but he's not Sherlock Holmes. So he's not tall and athletic. He's small and fat. He's not very British. He's foreign. And that is apparently how she came to the character. And Ustinov has this sort of wonderful line of sort of saying, well, I just tried to find the gap in all those knots and created my Poirot. So he just sort of says, well, you know, if he's this sort of, all that creates this sort of canvas that I think you can do something with. You can bring yourself to Poirot. Because it's not like he's been sharply defined as a thing in the books. He's kind of been sort of given a set of traits defined on what he's not. That gives you a lot of free rein. And you can see it, that Peter Ustinov is having fun, I think, creating the character. And then that translates into Evil Under the Sun. Everyone is having fun. They're all-star casts, but I think this and Death on the Nile are brilliant all-star casts. And even the Orient Express as well, in that they've got the right star for the right part. That these are on the big screen, they can play this character perfectly. They've cast brilliantly on that score. And it's not like we've got a whole load of names, come see this film, there's a lot of people in it. Because that won't work if you're just constantly looking at a set of famous people. But because they've cast so brilliantly, and, you know, some of these actors maybe not brilliant actors, but they are film stars. And so it captures what they can do iconically. Every role, I think, is just instantly in that character because it's brought to life by the right person. And hey, presto, you've got your list of suspects. You like all of them. Which one did it is then going to grip you for the rest of it. And I think other attempts to adapt that have gone down this route of going, oh, let's have an all-star cast, have kind of struggled because they kind of rely on the names. They've cast the names. The name is in there. They don't have that immediate, this is so-and-so. This is the slightly bitchy owner of the hotel. Maggie Smith is perfect. This is the sort of theatre producer, slightly catty theatre producer. Again, Roddy McDowall is perfect. Within seconds, you get that character. And at the heart of these adaptations, they do that brilliantly. And this is like fantastic.
Yeah, it has this almost comic book like that you see the image and you're like, I know who that is. They don't even have to speak any dialogue. They pop up on screen with the costumes. And you know, if you know the book, you're like, that's so-and-so. That's him, that's her, that's them. It's absolutely beautifully done. Yes.
But even if you don't know the book, you know that character instantly anyway. It's so visually well done. You sort of, the actor can perfectly embody that form. The costume is no one else. They can't, I think with some period dramas, you have this thing that they're period drama accurate. So all the women could probably swap costumes if they're the same age. It wouldn't make a difference. They've just given this is what young women wore in the 20s. We'll give it to all the young women in this. Whereas this, no one could change outfits at all. It would not work. If Maggie Smith and Diana Rigg changed what they were wearing, it would just look wrong on either of them or any of them. They all have to wear what was perfect for them. And it's like glorious, like watching it for that.
Yeah, I mean, I also watched a documentary that interviews Anthony Powell about his costume designs, and there's a whole gallery. I think I might have the same Blu-ray box that you have, Alan. And I think that just goes to show how much he created these characters based on actors and actresses playing them and then came up with that style. And I think it's complemented so well, obviously, with the Mallorca film locations and the Cole Porter music. I mean, to me, the first instance that I got to know Cole Porter music was through that film. I didn't even know it wasn't just a written soundtrack. And each time this opening theme comes up by Cole Porter, adapted from Cole Porter, and it's, you know, played by such a energetic orchestra as well, and in such great arrangements, it just complements the whole thing, right? It's the Mediterranean look, it's the lightheartedness, it's the great cast, it's the look of the costumes and the sets, and then this music playing along, and just, I think, carrying it along so beautifully. It's such a, you know, compared to Death on the Nile, which I also love, but which has these like long passages and it's a bit more serious around, especially the central drama. I think this one is not very serious, right? I mean, no one's really unhappy that Diana Rigg's gone except for her acting chops. But her character is really, really not lovable at all. And I think that's also why Ustinov works so well in this. He doesn't have to take things too seriously. He sympathizes with some of the characters, but he can be brilliant and witty and just fun vacationer as well. The scene where he, you know, tries to go for a swim is just, you know, simply one of my favorites. And he never makes it past the knees.
And the egg trick that he does for the young girl. Just lovely. He tries to cheer her up because, you know, she's being treated rather badly by her stepmom. And he does this trick with an egg and she's just shaking her head going like, oh my God, this is cringe.
Yeah, you old man. What are you doing?
You old man. And Ustinov is sitting there angelically sort of taking the rebuke. It's lovely, yeah.
I mean, I think it's an interesting contrast between that and Death on the Nile, because I do love both these films. But actually, I probably think Death on the Nile edges it for the same reasons that, Sam, you think this film edges it. Because I think the one thing I think this film slightly misses that I really like in Death on the Nile is there is a darkness there. And actually, I do like in Agatha Christie that, I know cozy crime is the epithet, but there's something at her best, there's a gnarliness, there's a nastiness underneath it. I think she was very good at understanding how cruel and ruthless humans could be to other humans. And she isn't necessarily sparing on that. I think there is an understanding that humans do this to other humans, and it'll be presented a bit as a plot convenience, but I think there's a very good understanding of that in her work. And so I think stuff like Death in the Nile, I like it when you have that darkness, when you have something that reminds you that we're not here for a bit of fluff. And I think Death on the Nile is, because it's slightly darker, I have a slight preference. And the only other thing, and this is purely personal, is one of my earliest memories and why I love adaptations of murder mysteries is I love the invented flashback when they describe what could have happened and you see it. I don't know why I love that in adaptations. There is something about having a guy, well, maybe this happened, and then you see like the actors going through, you see an actor murdering the person, but doesn't mean they did it. It's just showing you this hypothetical. I don't know why I love that so much. Death on the Nile is a banquet of that. It is so much of the film, and I love it for that. And Evil Under the Sun has its moments, and it's great. And I'll also say about Evil Under the Sun, the script is incredible.
It's very good, yeah.
It's not like Christie is a sacred text. We must keep everything the same. It knows the job. It respects the murder. It respects the mystery. You're still going to get the heart of the crime and the solution. But on top of that, it's funny. The characters are well drawn. It deserves awards to me. It's so good.
What's interesting, if our listeners are sort of want to see this again, this goes, I think, for this one, for the Death on the Nile as well, and also for the Suchet ones, note the reaction shots. It's been incredibly precisely done when, for instance, in this case, Redfern discovers the body. If you've read the book, you know how this is supposed to go, right? Watch what they do. They film Redfern, then they cut back to the boat. This is so deliberate and it's so cleverly done. And the Suchet pros, on their best days, have the same capacity that you think you see something, but on the screen, you actually see another character, a reaction shot, the shot of the ocean, a shot of the boat, a shot of something else. And you say, Alan, the sort of unreliable narrator flashbacks. This is probably one of my favorite things of these adaptations, is to note how the camera work is done around the plot so that you don't instantly see what the solution must be just by how is the actor supposed to react. I think that's so interesting.
Yeah, there's a brilliance in Christie in terms of her writing, how she handles misdirection in the text, that she puts you off solving the murder, but in a way that when you see the solution, you don't feel cheated. The misdirection isn't, you couldn't possibly work this out. I am just going to make this fun and a challenge. And the best adaptations do that misdirection with their sort of camera direction, with the shots they choose. And I think, yeah, this is a brilliant example of that.
But I agree with you, Alan, as well, that the writing that was put in there, and apart from what was already there from Christie, is great. And I think that's also one of the reasons why I love these adaptations, including, you know, the sometimes lesser appreciated Mirror Cracked. I think the camp that's in there, you know, I mean, Anthony Schaffer, who I love from, you know, Wicker Man and Sleuth and Frenzy and some of the other adaptations of Christie, he wrote this, but then they brought in Barry Sandler, apparently, to spruce up the dialogue. And I think one of the best aspects of Evil Under the Sun and The Mirror Cracked are some of the repartees between the female leads, right? I mean, who forgets Elizabeth Taylor and Kim Novak? The film is a little forgettable, but that scene when they first see each other again in the house is almost as good as the moment when Diana Rigg shows up at Daphne Castle's hotel and they have this, like, this super memorable, I don't know, drag queen-like repartee between how they had been showgirls in the same show. I mean, it's to die for. I think that's part of the reason why I love these 70s, 80s Christie adaptations so much.
Well, and don't think the dialogue is in the novel, right? They wrote this. I mean, I forget what's the name of the writer, the journalist in the sailor suit. I forget the actor's name. I'm sorry. Anyway, he's delicious. He's just annoying everybody all over the place. And the innuendo just pops off the screen. These things were written specifically for the movie. Those are fantastic.
I think it's Roddy McDowall, isn't it? And actually, there's an interesting parallel just before I rewatched Evil Under the Sun, is I was reading that apparently, like, Maggie Smith was talking about early in acting that she'd worked alongside Kenneth Williams, who in the UK is a very sort of famous camp actor. He appeared in a lot of comedy, very mannered, very funny, very over the top. And I've always been a huge fan of his. And actually, she's channeling Kenneth Williams in this. I'd never made the connection before, and she spoke about how influential Kenneth Williams was on her acting style, that to sort of embrace when you need to embrace going big, going for that style. And I think she is such a talented actor that she's able to do that without the character ever becoming a cartoon. She has enough to in her wheelhouse, but especially in Evil Under the Sun, there's a bit of Kenneth Williams in her performance, and I love it all the more for that. I mean, it's great.
Those two are just playing off of each other so well. I think what Maggie Smith and Dan Rick do with their voices, you know, the delivery, the speed, the pointedness, there's just something that, you know, it's not really the lines per se. It's just how you time it, how you look, and how you make it relatable, right? Without being just pure camp. Yeah, that's really, really probably my highlight.
And just in terms of double acts, I mean, she's in a double act with Bette Davis in Death on the Nile. And again, that's incredible. That is comedy gold. And on the making of, or I think it's one of the extras on that, on the Blu-ray for that, they make the point that Maggie Smith manhandles Bette Davis in that. And, you know, the person sort of makes the point, that's not going to happen. Bette Davis is not going to allow you to manhandle her unless she's absolutely sold that this is great. This is great stuff, that they've worked it out together. And she, to have the respect that Maggie Smith can do this to her, and it's like, yes, I know why this is. This is great. This is fantastic. And that double act is brilliant. And yeah, they sort of follow it up. They bring Maggie Smith back, and it's like, right, we're going to do a different double act. But it really works. It's another highlight in this.
Yeah, but Niall is so good. I mean, there is a compliment in that entire film where, as you say, Smith gets to manhandle Bette Davis, and it's a sort of compliment to Smith. And then you have our Salome Otterborn, who is a compliment to everyone.
She's so good. There's such star power in that one.
Smashing, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think definitely Evil Under the Sun has this sort of fun camp to us. I think the genius is that it is still a Christie story. They respect the story a lot, even as they're delivering a real sense of fun. I mean, the cleverness of the crime, and then the cleverness of how it is solved works. It lands. And I think that to do that while also having a fun time is actually incredibly hard to do. I think that's why a lot of Christie adaptations fail. Because, oh, it's about murder, we must take it seriously. Or, okay, there's fun, but if there's fun, the crime becomes less important. And I think this just gets the balance, they're both there, and you can watch it and be impressed by the crime and how it's solved and how the criminals are stopped, but you also just have a fun time. It's just a great film.
I mean, I realize this is one of my feel-good movies, you know, one of the top ones. I could just literally watch this again once it's ended. You know, I could just like press play again and I would completely not mind.
To just live in it. Yeah.
But just, I think, fun watches and adaptations, I think different types of adaptation brings us to, Julie, your choice. And we're going to the world of TV movies and the David Suchet Poirot series. And you picked Five Little Pigs.
I did.
What was the reason for picking this one?
For a specific reason. I mean, this is, the Poirot series is a very long-running series. David Suchet is famous for this role. There are a lot of stories about him never sort of being out of character and all that sort of stuff. I picked this one because this is one of the adaptations that is very faithful on the one hand, and then does something interesting with the novel on the other. So it manages both things. Also, it's beautifully done. Let me just point you to the pre-credit sequence, which is lovely. It's beautifully filmed, very period specific, with the car and the lights. And then Lucy Crail steps out and has her first meeting with Hercule Poirot. Pity that Hugh Fraser is not in this one, because I wanted to give him a shout out. He also does the audiobooks, and he does a smashing Suchet impression on the audiobooks. So thank you, Mr. Fraser, for that. It's a joy. The plot in this one follows the novel precisely, basically. Pieces of dialogue are exact copies. So there is this lady, Lucy Crail, who visits Poirot. She has a commission for him. Her mother was hanged in the past for the murder of her father, and she quite simply doesn't believe her mother did it. So she enlists Poirot to find out the truth one way or another, sort this out. So this is one of Christie's sort of, I don't know, hobby horses, the crime in the past, right? She did more than one of these where crime needs to be solved that goes way back. So Poirot interviews all the characters. And in the end, we have this exposition, as we are used to, with all the characters sitting in one big room and Poirot holding a monologue and solving the crime for us. So in that sense, nothing's changed. This is the plot. This is what they're going to do. We need some really great actors for this because, again, so much of this is just dialogue between Poirot and one character. And there's not a lot of action because most of the action is in the past and therefore via flashbacks, right? So it's interesting how they approached this to begin with. And then they don't change the novel at all. And then they change almost everything about the characters themselves without changing the story. And that's why this one interests me, because they do this several times in the Poirot series. Some of them, they even change the entire ending. It's really weird. But in this one, they don't. And you have, for example, Philip Blake is one of the characters. And Philip Blake was a witness to the murder. He was the best friend of the victim, Amnius Crail, the painter. And in the book, he's one of these affluent British, you know, casually misogynist types, very brawny, very horsey, that sort of thing. In the episode, he's played by Toby Williams of James Bond fame, who is so charismatic that my screen nearly exploded. And he is played in a way that immediately suggests that it's not just this murder in the past that weighs on his mind. He has gone completely to pieces. This man has unwound. This man is broken fundamentally. And at the end, we find out why. And this is not in the novel, right? Because for this quite the simple reason that Agatha Christie wouldn't have written about such a thing and probably couldn't have written about such a thing, because this Philip Blake, whose best friend Amnius Crail was in love with him. So the victim was probably the love of his life. And suddenly you get a depth of character that was never there in the book, or at least I couldn't find it. I revisited the book and I looked through this entire interview between Poirot and Philip Blake. And is there a hint of any of this? You could make one, but it's not immediately apparent. And I don't think Christie meant it to be there. This character is not coded in any way. There's no hints, signs, portents, nothing. And this is the interesting thing. And I think this is one of the things that makes the series so great as a whole. And then I'm going to stop monologuing because I'm going to start sounding like Poirot. Is this is what they do. At their very best, they take the story straight as it is. They take some of the dialogue straight as it is. They take the characters and the actors change something fundamental and deepen the story in that way.
How about you, Sam? What did you make of it?
Well, another admission, I had not watched a David Suchet series at all. I was very aware of it because it was always on television, especially British television stations. And I knew his face, his figure, but a little bit like the Rutherford films. When I came to this, I realized, no, this is someone I knew as Hercule Poirot. I had seen him in bits and pieces, but not watched a series at all. So this was my very first episode watching this. So everyone who's a Christie fan can now hate on me and ask, why did they put him on that episode? I really am a movie guy, so I realize that I know mostly like film adaptations and less so the long-running TV shows, including Marple and Poirot, actually. So my main interest was seeing him in the role versus Ustinov. And I think that's one thing that I really liked about it. Suchet is great in it. I think he's such a different Poirot. The intensity of his eyes, the little dark moustache that kind of hovers on top of his lips as he's really looking very deeply at these characters while he talks to them. The seriousness, the empathy, but also the kind of skepticism that he has is brilliant. I loved him in the role. They're very complementary to each other. You know, there's no camp and showmanship. Or not much in the Ustinov style here. It's much more subtle, but he's Poirot for sure. And obviously I was intrigued because I didn't read about the story of Five Little Pigs. I hadn't read the book that it's based on to see the stellar cast, you know, Toby Stevens, who is Maggie Smith's son, and Rachel Sterling, who's Diana Rigg's daughter. Yeah. I mean, I thought, oh, this was chosen on purpose. This is a little casting game.
It is.
And to see them, you know, 2003 at the height of their TV and movie starring powers, Toby Stevens, you know, Bond villain a year before, but also in a lot of like James Bond audio adaptations. And Rachel Sterling, I think, was in Doctor Who and a lot on television as well, including parts or episodes with her mom. So I think I just approached this also from, you know, who do I know perspective at first. But I was really intrigued by the plot and by, yeah, as opposed to Evil Under the Sun, how serious this was, you know, to kind of to find somehow rectification for someone who was possibly wrongfully hanged, wrongfully killed. The daughter that's, you know, so serious about her plea to Poirot at the beginning, then these interviews that are very intense, and the flashbacks that we get, very different approach to a Poirot story. And I could imagine that this must have been brilliant to see that on a regular basis produced like a feature film. I was astonished by how well this was done. And I think Evil Under the Sun, the adaptation, started right after on my Daily Motion channel. So I was tempted to also watch this. But I was confused by the fact that it's not set in the Mediterranean, so I stopped. Great stuff.
I'm really glad that Julie picked this one, because this is my favorite of all the Suchet episodes for the reasons Julie gave. I think the history of the TV show is it starts off as a Sunday night TV show that has like 50-minute episodes where they're very much adapting Poirot's short stories. And because of the nature of the short stories, they have a lot of leeway to invent stuff, because some of the short stories are pages long. So to fill 50 minutes, they end up building the part of the sort of Poirot's friends are regulars. So Captain Hastings is in every episode, his friend, Inspector Japp is in. So they have this sort of supporting cast that's pretty much in every episode.
Lemon.
Yeah, Miss Lemon. And it's these 50-minute adventures that are sort of slightly linked to the short stories, but they are their own thing. And that was so successful that at a certain point they said, right, there's these novels, these big successes. Let's spend more money and make these sort of 90-plus minute television movies adapting the books. And I think, for me, they're a bit hit and miss in their adaptation. Suchet is always brilliant. And I think this is the one where everything lands. David Suchet is incredible. His performance is absolutely, possibly I would say, the best performance by someone playing an Agatha Christie detective. I think he's so good in it. I think the way it's dramatically structured, each interview is brilliant. It's actors, the way they weave it all together, the way you get the insight into what happened compared to where they are now and their regrets. It is so brilliantly written as like a engaging drama. And then it builds to a really satisfying end. And I think the depth to it eclipses the book. I think Julie's absolutely right on that. There's more to this than even, I think, in the original novel. There's others that I like less, but I do like the bravery of thinking we don't have to do everything the same. Because when it pays off, as in this, it's brilliant. I think this is the one, I sort of binged watched all of it as a bit of a post-lockdown project. And this came up as just, this is perfect. This is like, it's the best of the Suchet Poirots, and the Suchet Poirots are some of the best Agatha Christie adaptations you'll ever see. So I don't know how much more I can up the recommendation, but I think this is just a real sort of masterpiece of television.
Yeah, and take, for instance, Mark Warren. Mark Warren plays Meredith Blake. So in the book, he's basically sketched as an eccentric man who inherited his money and has hobbies and is a very sort of old-fashioned, you know, stick in the mud. And I never know who comes up with these things, right? But Mark Warren plays him almost as a knight of Arthurian fiction. His face and the way he carries himself and his romanticism, right? It's a beautiful performance, even if he is pretty much an ancillary character, but everyone is so important in this. And to my sort of, when I rewatched this for the show here, I really had to laugh because a very small part is reserved for Mr. Patrick Malahide, who I don't know if everybody knows him, but it was a quite big deal. And he's credited separately in the credit sequence, right, with David Suchet and so on, and Patrick Malahide. And he's like on screen for 3 minutes playing a judge or an attorney or some such, who does some of the exposition and then is gone. So, and it's interesting because this is so well done. And so, as you say, Alan, rightly so, really well written as well. Even though they do lift lots of dialogue from the book, that doesn't mean that they don't need to write it. So that was interesting to me. It was a little bit sort of cute where one of your actors ends up in a James Bond film, but you sort of start with Anne Patrick Malahide, which I think is always very cute in these sort of types of early adaptations.
Everyone's really good in this. I think it also hinges on the central couple, right? Aidan Gillen and Rachel Sterling. I think they have to work as well, being both possibly very much in love and hating each other at the same time, or being unfaithful or being untruthful and so on. So I think that the dynamic really works well. Aidan Gillen I knew mostly from Queer as Folk from the 1990s, early 2000s. So he's kind of this gigolo character. And I think he picks up on this here as well, that you don't quite know to what extent he can be trusted or he really cares for Rachel Sterling. And I think she's great. I don't think I'd seen her really in anything else except for bits and pieces either. And I think just the flashbacks, seeing her being hanged at the beginning, obviously, but then also seeing her in so many different situations and also not quite knowing to what extent she was involved, or she reacted, she was emotional about things, or she was involved in certain situations, and her role that she eventually played. I think she did that really, really well as well. I did hear a little bit her mom's diction every once in a while. Yeah, I was like, oh yeah, I can see how that's Diana Rigg's daughter, because she has a similar way of pronouncing or intoning things sometimes. But she's very good in this as well.
Yeah, it's a very thankless role in many respects, I think, because in the book she's just basically, she's a MacGuffin almost, right? She's just described from outside. One of the characters calls her, you know, manipulative, you know, horrible, superficial person. The other says she was a real lady. The nanny, Miss Williams, who is played to great effect by Gemma Jones, guys, she's wonderful in this. Anyway, she has it right, as nannies tend to in Christie novels, right? Listen to the nanny, guys, she's always right. She projects another image, right, on this alleged murderess. So it's a thankless role for her, because she has to visualize these projections in a way that tells you nothing. I don't think it's a very sort of plumb part. You have to just sort of be there and be projected upon. But she does really well. Yeah. And the actor who plays Amnius, ditto. He just has to be there and be charismatic into the void.
But also, I think what this adaptation does really well is part of its genius is the dramatization brings you towards the truth. And then when you realize the truth, you can go back. And their performances fit into that, even though when you're watching it initially, you've just been told, oh, she was a bit manipulative. You see a scene where it looks like she's being manipulative and you buy it. When you watch it again, you suddenly realize, no, she all through the time, she was kind. She was like trying to be nice. And I think they get that so well in that, again, that sense of misdirection that's never a cheat. They don't have her act really nasty and manipulative. And then when you get the end, when they say, oh, she wasn't, we'll just have to take it on trust that what we saw earlier was just to fool us. Whereas here, it's fooling us, but it's not having to cheat. It is showing up. And I think the performances are really good on that. And I think they're sort of very invested in the humanity of the characters, that they're more than just these sort of sometimes ciphers or something that is in the Christie story. So I think it's a really good, really good adaptation. I'm really glad you brought it to the table so I got to rewatch it. We did the three stories. I was just wondering if anyone has any sort of honourable mentions, anything they were going to suggest that didn't quite make it to the table.
Well, Sam already mentioned Mirror Cracked, but there's also this really sort of sweet adaptation of They Do It With Mirrors, which features Betty Davies when she was quite far along. I think she already had one of her strokes. Very fragile. And it's not a very good adaptation. It's really not a very good movie. But it's one of those things. I mean, I celebrate all of them, right? Mm. In that way, where they get out the big star and they have a nice little cozy mystery and it's all a bit messy, but it doesn't really matter. They're very sort of dear things and lovely. So I thought that deserved a mention. And of course, The Mirror Cracked. If it was just for Liz and Kim, you It's worth the time.
How about you, Sam? Is it?
I agree. I was thinking at first of suggesting Mirror Crack just because of what you just said, Julie. And just because of the fact that Angela Lansbury kind of got her gig in Murder, She Wrote based on having played Miss Marple, not very, she wasn't very popular in the role. They didn't do a second movie with her, but she got the role in the TV show after. I was also thinking of just pointing out Piper Laurie in Appointment by Death. I always thought that's why I love this film, even though the film is not very good. But she's so magnetic in this, as in as many other things. I would probably point out Endless Night. I recently wrote an article about it. This early 1970s Christie adaptation of a much later novel by her. So it doesn't feature Poirot or doesn't feature Miss Marple. But just a very interesting adaptation with a great Bernard Herrmann score. So I think it's just to see this for completion's sake, I would say go for it, because there's enough production values and intrigue, even though the film as a whole is not very good.
And it's a very dark story. Again, Alan alluded to this at the beginning. There is a darkness in Christie that sometimes sort of gets, I don't know, popified in the sense that we don't really look at it that way. But this, The Endless Nights, is a story, and also there are several adaptations of it, by the way, that sort of reminds us that this does not come from a cheerful place.
I mean, I was sort of thinking that, like, Endless Night, there's a whole load of Agatha Christie books that aren't Poirot Marple, that sort of, they don't get adapted so much. They don't get so much attention, because I think Marple and Poirot are the brand. They're very easy to sell. They're very, like, you know, you've gotten in already. Oh, it's this famous detective. I do like the BBC had a recent adaptation of Then There Were None, which I think is a very good story of hers about, yeah, I think it's sort of like all these people are invited to a remote island that's cut off from the land, and then this sort of record plays and it's a mystery for all of them. Now, why were they brought there? And then obviously they start dying and what's going on? And I think it's a clever plot that stands up to an adaptation. There's quite a few adaptations. Quite a few of them are watchable, but I thought the BBC did an especially good one.
Yeah, it's spoofed to great effect through Murder by Death.
Oh, yeah. The spoofs, yeah.
Which features Truman Capote and Peter Sellers and Peter Falk. And it's not that good, but it is delicious in a way.
Yeah. And I was just sort of thinking in terms of if Five Little Pigs hadn't been picked as a Suchet, but if people sort of do want to look at what other Suchets to watch, I think their adaptation of the ABC Murders is good.
Yeah, it's very good.
I think that again, I think I have a very high bar for that one just because it's the first one I read. So most adaptations I sort of watch and I'm like, no, this isn't my ABC Murders. But I think the Suchet one is the closest to really get the thrill of that story. So if Sam, you wanna explore any more, that would be a good next one to watch. And I suppose just following on from that, just quickly, like, are there any that sort of we want to see adapted or adapted again? Is there anything on the Christie canon that people like? I think the one I would love to see, because it feels like a challenge, is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. My theory on how to do this, and this is purely mine, is you do it like an episode of Columbo. So you would reveal to everyone who the killer is at the beginning, and then you would have the story with Poirot turning up and working it out, because it's such a challenge to adapt. It's such a famous book. It's such a clever book. But I think I'm intrigued as to how you could possibly adapt it. And I'd be intrigued by someone else having a stab at it. That would be my approach, but people would have different approaches. Is there any others in the canon that people would like to see adapted or adapted again?
I agree with Ackroyd. The whole unreliable narrator, first person shtick lends itself pretty well to film, I think, or should do. It's been done. Ackroyd has been adapted. I mean, it's not like it hasn't, but there would be a movie in that. Yeah, I think so.
The adaptations I've seen, I don't think they quite work. I think there's still scope for someone to do an Ackroyd adaptation that really lands. What about you, Sam?
No, I just want to put a restraining order on Kenneth Branagh around the Agatha Christie books to make sure he never adapts one again. But if he, for instance, did Evil Under the Sun, I just, you know, want to see it for how much worse it would be to the 1982 version. But that's just my little Schadenfreude.
We'll get an injunction against Mr. Branagh.
The thing is, a shame that you know we've got the big budget Branagh Poirots, but no one's doing a big budget Marple. And I feel that's a gap in the market. Let's have someone spend huge amounts of money and lots of CGI to recreate St. Mary Mead with Miss Marvel.
Yeah, but even I think what irritates me about the Branagh is that he does neither. He does neither the big flashy camp fun thing that Ustinov and Rutherford in her way did, nor does he quite tap into the seriousness of the Suchet Poirot. So he does neither. If he did, Mr. Branagh, you could do, for example, The Hollow, which is a very simple story with just one location with a great cast. And if you do it well, it will work, you know? It's just, why can't they get these things to tick? Somehow they're lifeless. I don't know why.
And at the same time, you know, Knives Out has already brought out kind of brilliant Christie pastiche. So I think that, you know, what Branagh tried to do, Daniel Craig is not doing as Benoit Blanc. I think that's really the port of the modern age.
And I think the Knives Out do brilliantly. That's something I love about Agatha Christie, the misdirection. That when you're told the truth in those films, it doesn't feel like you've cheated me to get here. Actually, you can watch the film again and then suddenly it all makes sense. Like, obviously that was the killer, and obviously, like, I should have known that was the killer. And that sense that, like, the direction, the storytelling has that clever misdirection, I think, is at the heart, I think, of Christie's genius, and the adaptations that work land that. So if there's any future coming up, it would be, do that, get that right.
Reminds me of Dame Niall Marsh, who's also a big Golden Age detective writer, and she quips at the beginning of one of her detective books that she gave the manuscript to Roderick Allen of the police force, chief inspector, and he said to her, who's going to read a book where you tell them who's done it at the very first chapter of the book? And she proceeds to do so. She actually tells you who did it in the first chapter of the book. And then it ends up being the person you think did it in the first chapter of the book. It's just that in the rest of the book, you become convinced that he did not do it. This is what we need more of.
Yeah, just that misdirection, but without cheating, I think is really important. No, I think as the chief inspector leads away all our opinions on the Agatha Christie lineup, it just, I think, remains for me to thank all our listeners, guilty and innocent alike. And I'd like to thank suspects Sam and Julie. I think you've been exonerated. I think you're not guilty in this instance.
Thank you, Inspector.
It was a pleasure.
And join us next time for another damn fine cup of culture. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.